You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Cotney. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. And I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword, elders.
This is in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the United States. We stand with you.
We're poor, Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe. We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it,
Whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe. We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe. We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Porto, Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Heywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, John
Henry Clark, John G. Jackson, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at sankofacouncilmke@gmail.com. And I repeat, sankofacouncilmke@gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword, elders.
Welcome, this is Dr. Janine James, and we are at the Black Reality Think Tank with our program sponsored by the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. We have Brother Charles Robinson, who's here along with me today, and we're looking forward to an exciting program. I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I'm just so delighted to be here with you, so that we can begin to do that which the Sankofa Council feels are important. And our purpose of our organization is to use African principles of unity and cooperation to create a healing environment for our community. We're talking today about the subject abortion. And that's a pretty broad term, but we've had some really interesting things happening in the news. Texas recently passed an abortion law, and I think it's important that we as a community understand what this conversation is about, what the impact is. And I've worked in this area for many years as an obstetrician gynecologist, but there are many things in terms of the legal aspects that aren't so clear to me. And in an effort to try to get a better understanding about this, I began to think about how we can share this information with our listeners. Our discussions will be with our guests, Attorney Ann McNeely and Carol McKinney Rice, about the significance of this law and how Black families are impacted. You may not be a female or a past, or you are past childbearing and parenting age, but this issue impacts the health of women and families, especially Black families. So for that reason, it is worthy of our conversation. Unfortunately, we don't have with us Sister Dee Dee for our ancestral profile, so I'm going to have to step in with her contribution. And we're going to be talking today in our ancestral profile about Lloyd Barbie. Lloyd Barbie was born March.
Dr. James, I'm sorry. I'm getting really bad feedback. Is there something that can be done about that? This is Attorney McNeely. I really want to be able to hear what you're saying on Lloyd Barbie.
Unfortunately, hopefully it will stop. And we do have some interference sometimes with some outside hackers. And I don't know if they're playing a role in that, but we're going to have to try to move forward.
Dr. Yes, James, ma'am.
If I could,
thank you, Dr.
If you
James.
Could,
well, Perhaps one thing you can do is hang up and then dial back in.
Brother Charles, can you hold on a minute, please? Sister James, I think it's coming from your mic.
I mean, if the feedback is significant, I would recommend just try and hang up and then dial back in and see if you get a better connection.
Brother Charles, it's coming from Sister James.
Okay, yeah, it's not coming when you speak, but when Dr. James talks, it's like it's coming in. I apologize for the interruption.
Yes, Lloyd Barbie joined the NAACP at age 12. He served in the United States Navy from 1943 to 1946. In 1949, he graduated from all-black Lemoyne Owens College and enrolled at the University of Wisconsin Law School. But he soon dropped out due to the racial prejudice of some faculty and students. Later, he returned to the UW, and in 1955, he was elected president of the Madison chapter of the NAACP. He then completed law school in 1956. In 1962, Barbie moved to Milwaukee, which was very racially segregated. In 1963, working for the NAACP, he challenged the Milwaukee Public Schools to integrate. The school system refused, claiming that the segregation of its schools resulted not from its policies, but from segregated neighborhoods. In response, Barbie organized civil rights activists into the Milwaukee United School Integration Committee, which was called MUSIC. This organization boycotted the schools and blocked buses, aiming to bring attention to the problem. In 1964, Barbie ran to represent what was then the 6th District of Milwaukee in the Wisconsin State Assembly and won. From 1965 to 1977, he was the only African American in the state legislature. During that time, he introduced a state fair housing bill and worked for fair employment, gay rights, women's rights, prison reform, legalization of drugs and prostitution, disarming police officers, and taxation of churches. Sound familiar? Some things we've been talking about more recently. The school boycotts did not sway Milwaukee's school board. So in 1965, Barbie filed a federal lawsuit, Amos et al. Versus the Board of School Directors of the City of Milwaukee, arguing that MPS's neighborhood school policy did indeed preserve and intensify school segregation. This claim was supported by research conducted by Barbie's as well as other volunteers. The case ground on for years, with Barbie often working alone against MPS's lawyers. But in 1976, federal judge John Reynolds ruled in favor of Barbie. And he said, "I conclude that segregation exists in Milwaukee public schools." Oh, that's nothing new. We've been talking about that forever. "And that this segregation was intentionally created and maintained by the defendants. MPS appealed the decision all the way to the Supreme Court, but that court supported Judge Reynolds' judgment and Barbie's case. In 1979, MPS agreed to change its policies and began making progress toward integrating its schools. Between 1965 and 1971, African American state legislators introduced bills to reform or repeal abortion laws in New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Michigan, and our own Wisconsin. With the exception of Dorothy Brown, a physician who introduced legislation to reform Tennessee's abortion law in 1967. These legislators are ignored. With the exception of Brown, these politicians were all men. Lloyd Barbie introduced a bill to reform Wisconsin's abortion law in 1965 and in 1967. Now, this was prior to Roe versus Wade. That I found very interesting. He became the first politician in the nation to introduce legislation that would repeal a state abortion law and thus legalize abortion. Barbie is the only Black state legislator who worked to legalize abortion. His thoughts evolved on the meaning and politics of abortion, as well as his collaboration with early women's rights advocates, who persuaded him that the decision to abort should be made by women, not physicians. In later years, Barbie continued his law practice, and from 1978 to 2000, he taught in the Africology Department at UW-Milwaukee, and he continued to work for justice and social change in Milwaukee until he died in the year 2002. Barbie is remembered as the attorney who led the fight to desegregate Milwaukee schools, not as a pioneer in the struggle for reproductive rights. Feminist history have largely credited the radical branch of the feminist movement with formulating and popularizing the notion that abortion is a woman's right, but Barbie's papers tell a more complex story. From the beginning, the struggle for reproductive rights has been intertwined with the struggle for racial justice. This is Lloyd Barbie, 1932 to 2002, and this is a Milwaukee person who has some pretty incredible history, which is very much what we talk about with our programs, the importance of us knowing our history, and so I'm glad to be able to share that information with this body here. As I said, I'm somewhat in a position of being taking the role of Dee Dee today, and so I'm going to be serving as not only your host, but you may hear me popping in as a guest. So I'm going to give you a quick background on myself. I'm a physician gynecologist and obstetrician and a maternal fetal medicine specialist. That means high-risk pregnancies. I was recruited to the Milwaukee University of Wisconsin Medical School to teach medicine to its Milwaukee clinical campus students. I have an independent practice, the Perinatal Center of Wisconsin, and a patient advocacy website and telehealth practice, eDoc Advice. I am a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, a member of the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, and I play a role in producing this program that we're hearing today, which I host and broadcast to African Americans about our history and the principles of self-determination and cooperation. My passion has been the prevention of maternal and fetal death through my practice and education. I'm the mother of an adult son and his queen. She is the proud parent, and I am now a G-mom, grandmother, to three brilliant and beautiful G-babies, grandbabies, and I advise and care for many mothers and their families who wish to discuss their concerns regarding continuing their pregnancies. Now to our real guests, and our first guest will be Attorney Ian McNeely. Attorney McNeely has been an attorney for over 18 years. Her experience includes general law practice in southeastern Wisconsin. The practice is titled James Curtis Legal Services, LLC. She provides advice and counsel to matters involving school law, employment law, landlord, tenants, cybersecurity policy, contracts, and criminal litigation. Prior to practicing law, Ms. McNeely was an actuarial analyst, oh my goodness, and system analyst for Web Technologies. Ms. McNeely is active in the community and currently serves on the board with the Waukesha NAACP, JC Legal Resources Center, Inc., and the North Teutonia Avenue Business Association. Ms. McNeely attended Brookfield Central High School. She holds a BA in mathematics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Juris Doctorate from Marquette University Law School. We welcome Attorney Ian McNeely.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
We hear you.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you so much for having me tonight, and thank you for giving the history on Lloyd Barbee. You know, in 2005, when the NAACP had its national convention in Milwaukee, the lawyers always get together for CLEs at the convention, and we had a celebration at the end of our CLE on behalf of Lloyd Barbee. So we celebrated his work in our community and the change that he's, brought to the area and helped us realize our civil rights dreams in Milwaukee. The fight's still there, but, you know, he's a great role model. He's been very influential. So thank you for that. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate your being here and sharing that his story with us about Lloyd Barbee and your experience as well. And we're going to be coming back to you in just a moment, but I want to also welcome our guest, Ms. Carol McKinney Rice. She is a Milwaukee native who graduated from James Madison High School. She received a bachelor's degree in business administration from Dillard University in New Orleans, Louisiana, a master's degree in business management and Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee. She is currently vice president of operations at Columbia Savings and Loan and a pro-choice supporter. She is the mother of two adult children, and she is a member of Delta Sigma Theta sorority. And in terms of disclosures, I need to say that the guests and the hosts are all members of Delta Sigma Theta sorority. And Carol McKinney Rice, we're so happy to have you with us today. You got my attention this past week after having sent a Facebook post regarding the Texas law, the Texas Heartbeat Act, and it really got my interest because it's a subject that you and I have not discussed over these many years, but I was certainly fascinated in your interests. And it got me to thinking about the fact that we need to understand. You, of course, are making that effort to understand and show your support. But we'd like to be able to engage our listeners in a better understanding about this whole issue of abortion. And I want to thank you again, Sister Carol, for being here with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I look forward to the discussion. It's something that I feel very strongly about, being a pro-choice person, because I believe that it is an individual's right. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having you. Now, let's get to the question about why is there even a discussion? I thought we had dealt with this in 1973 with the passing of Roe versus Wade, which I thought served over these almost 50 years to protect the right for women to safely pursue to have an abortion. Of course, there have been lots of discussions over these many years, but Attorney McNeely,
Yes. Why
is this even being discussed? How is it that Texas is coming up with this as some new legislation?
Well, you know, I don't know why Texas is coming up with this new legislation, but there has been a trend, especially since the most recent or the past election in 2016. There's been a growing trend in having abortion be a highly politicized issue that for some reason is taking a lot of air. I know since 2000, I think it was like 2000, 2015, states have passed like over 1,000 different pieces of legislation to limit abortion already. But this is now the time where Texas is actually taking the abortion prohibitions one step even further, you know, where it's making it almost impossible for women to have access to abortion. So this new law is very similar to what other states have been trying to do for the past 20 years, but it goes a little further. It's a little bit more trickier. It's a law that now is not looking to the state or prosecutors to intervene on these abortion issues. It's made abortion something that the citizens will enforce. And that's that little nuance has really made it's the impact of the Texas legislation a game changer, you know, and we can talk more about that later. But, you know, abortion in America has, you know, I don't really even understand the true rationale behind the history. In 1973 with Roe v. Wade, there was such opposition in play, very similar to today in the opposite direction, where people were opposing abortion very strongly. And even the litigants from the Roe v. Wade case have a heck of a story to tell. You know, after the Supreme Court decision was issued, their lives were changed drastically. A lot of hateful people coming in their way. And now it's moved, the pendulum has swung all the way to the other direction. But Lord knows what the actual reason is. But it does create a control element in the interest of patriarchy. So now taking away a woman's right to choose is powerful, especially if you're trying to maintain something like a patriarchal society where women are not allowed to have choices over their own body.
I would have to agree with that wholeheartedly. It is more a matter of control rather than a concern for many of these politicians. Just being able to exercise control over other people, because it is not only abortion rights or women's reproductive health rights that are being rolled back. It's laws that will allow a group of people to maintain control over others. And it's really unfortunate, and it means that we all need to work even harder despite the rolling back of voting rights, that we get out there and do our part.
Dr. Jenkins, this is a listener, and I think one of the business about voting is so important. If you will remember, there is a past president who promised that if he got in, he would see to it that Roe versus Wade would be overturned. And in doing so, he has had the opportunity to appoint several Supreme Court justices who feel the same way. So as Carol said, voting is very important. And so now we find ourselves in a particular, in a peculiar position. And I just wanted to throw that in when she mentioned voting.
Thank you. Thank you so much for contributing that piece of information. I want to also, as a guest, include a little what my history has been. During this particular time, I was of the hearing of Roe versus Wade. I was a college student, and I knew of people who sought legal abortions, and at the time, they had to travel to New York City to obtain a safe abortion, which, of course, that would limit the number of people who were able to afford to make that trip, not only paying for the procedure, but the travel and travel expenses involved. I subsequently went to medical school and also to a residency in obstetrics and gynecology. And during this time, after Roe versus Wade, abortion was legal. Those procedures were performed in hospitals and in off-site locations safely. And what many people are not really aware of is what contributed to the sentiment, even though it wasn't always stated, of why this became an important decision. And that was, on a medical side, when a woman decides that she does not want to be pregnant, and this goes back through history, she finds some sort of way to end that pregnancy. Sometimes it ends her as in that process. And in fact, in the last century, there were many women who either died or were seriously injured by self in inducing an abortion, attempting an abortion on themselves, or going to persons who were not trained in how to do this, how to evaluate the woman. And so it was, there were few families, despite race, age, ethnicity, who had not a story to tell about someone that they knew who died attempting to end a pregnancy. And that became a real, real concern. I think we began to talk about so many issues in terms of the life of the child. But no matter how you try to look at it, and I've been looking at this for over 40 years, it still gets back to the only person who's able to do this is the woman, to continue the pregnancy. And for anybody who's been pregnant, you know what this does to your body, your thinking, your livelihood. So for you not to want to be pregnant and not want to have a child, to expect someone to go through this is just unrealistic. And there's something that I call post-abortion or post-birth abortions, I call it. And this is where a mother is coerced or shamed into continuing a pregnancy, but she basically says, I do not want to serve in that role of mother, of parent. And so she's detached herself in many ways. And we are seeing some of the consequences of that, of post-birth abortion, where people are not being nurtured, not being parented, because you cannot make someone do that. And then you add on top of this, those women who have been victimized through rape or incest, and then expect that they are going to serve as the vessel for bringing to life another human being is just not very realistic. That's all I'm going to say on that, unless you have some questions. But I'm again very happy to have us here in this discussion. Brother Charles, were you prepared to give our sponsor announcement?
No, let me see. No, I'm not.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you for that.
Well, Dr. James, this is Lynette. If I could say a few things.
Yes, please.
You know, I'm a history buff, right? And maybe that's because of, you know, the way I was raised, but I think, you know, definitely even I noticed tonight we go through our ancestry and we acknowledge history, right? I think it's going to be important to consider history when it comes to this abortion issue. And going back to 1973, I think it's, you know, I wasn't there, at least I wasn't conscious, but at that time, but from reading through that time period and looking at the aggregation of events, with Nixon, I believe, was president at the time, there was a growing unrest in America with when it comes to racial issues. Women were asserting their rights for the first time. More and more women were going to college. And the abortion issue was coming onto the table as well, right? And I think acknowledging those dynamics makes the abortion discussion quite interesting. Then going back even further into the 1920s, when abortion became, was put on the table, or at least the advocacy and the lobbying was beginning with Margaret Sanger, who was, from what I understand, she was one of the proponents of abortion that, you know, went around to different philanthropic groups to get funding or to help get funding for women to get abortions, and it was for women in poverty. And women who were mentally unstable, right? And definitely women who were in the minority classes. Those were the groups that Margaret Sanger wanted, from what I understand, wanted to focus on when it comes to encouraging abortion. I'm not sure how we should interpret those two points in history today, but I don't really have an opinion as to either way. I'm not politicizing this event or this issue. I don't have a political perspective on this issue, but it's a little concerning to know that the rise of abortions in this country has that derivative history of being something that came out of either oppression of minorities and women and poor, or at a time when there was unrest in the country, politically or socially. And so I don't know how to reconcile those two things. But today it seems that the majority of people who get abortion are white women. I think from 2004, it was 52% of all the abortions were had in the year 2004. 52% of them were with white women, and 35% were with black women. And then there's a 12.1% other. And those women, only 41% had no children, and women got abortions who had one child at 26%, two children at 19%, and three or more at 12%. And those numbers, and actually, I think 82% of these women were unmarried, and 17 were actually married who got abortions. So, you know, so who is this issue for? Who is it protecting? I'd love to hear what the panelist's perspective is on that. You know?
I think you're going to find, as you presented to us, is that it's very diverse in terms of the decisions to abort a pregnancy. And I think it is important for us to pay attention to the fact that, again, this would be disproportionate in the number of African-American women who are pursuing abortion. You have many women who say that they would never abort a pregnancy until they find themselves now a grandmother and pregnant. And in the last century, we had lots of cases of that where there was no contraception or not very reliable contraception. And so you have women who never even imagined that they could be pregnant. And I think that's a problem with education that continues to be a problem with our education, why we've done such a poor job of helping people to understand this process and what should go into, and we've got to really be able to separate that group of women who are coerced or forced into sexual contact and becoming pregnant, and those women who basically felt they couldn't get pregnant or that they wished they didn't get pregnant, and now they're thinking about how this is going to impact their lives. And this, frankly, for me in my career, became a big factor that not so much the availability of abortion, but the availability to women to understand how you're pregnant and what considerations need to be made so that if you do not want to be pregnant, that you don't have to be pregnant. And then the subject of what's going on with the men and what role are they playing in if they don't want to be fathers, if they don't want that role, what is it that they are doing to make sure that that doesn't happen? And I'm just appalled that over this many years, in terms of contraception for men, we haven't gotten any further than condoms. And that's what's been used throughout history. So,
Dr. Jane.
Yes, sir.
Maybe this is a good time to, before we get into that part of the discussion, to introduce our sponsor.
Okay. Please do.
Which is eDoc Advice. It is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health or medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions
about your personal health that makes sense to you. We do not replace your health professionals or provide you care, but we can help you to become a better consumer so that you can get the best information to make a truly informed decision. We network with other health professionals throughout the country and bring that information to you.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that information. And we want to begin to think about, we've got some persons on the line who would like to join our discussion. And I think it's probably, so we don't have to cut them off. Let's let them come in after the top of the hour. I'm going to ask Sister Carol, do you have some points that you'd like to raise in this few minutes before we go to the top of the hour?
Yes. I guess what I would like to circle back around with is the Texas situation. I just find it deplorable that this law is creating what was mentioned to me as basically bounty hunting for, you know, people to target as far as the lawsuits against anyone who might aid or abet someone who is trying to get an abortion, seeking abortion information. And it's discouraging, to say the least, that as you briefly mentioned, that men are still not being held accountable for their part in the situation. So it's disconcerting to me, and very troublesome to see that the control over our bodies, women's bodies, are yet again being hijacked because of someone else's control.
Thank you for sharing that point with us. That is very helpful. And I'm sure we're going to be able to explore this a little bit more as we go to our top of the hour, and we'll be back.
You know, Dr. James, I think we have a few seconds before we get to the top of the hour. It's interesting how, if we look back,
I was rolling in my car when I pulled up at the mall, couldn't find a place to park. Threw my keys to the valley. I was only there to hang, wasn't looking for a thing. I was just about to bounce, and then I saw Miss Lady. Then I said to myself, in her hand, right in front of Macy's. That's why the pretty girls hang. Then I saw her at the food court, sipping lemonade, conversating on her cell phone, looking so amazing.
She gon' be the one, we gon' fall in love.
Take her to the cookhouse. Take her to my mama's house. She'll need a hair done. I'll treat her like a queen. Give her everything. She will be my girl till we all in grave. And I knew it from the moment that I saw her. Some of your time.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com. And I repeat, Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword elders.
Welcome. We're back, and we're being visited by, I guess you can call them ghosts. Maybe that's a good way. That seem to find the subject of interest and are doing some meddlesome stuff with our programming. But we're not going to let that stop us. We're going to keep moving forward. And I'd like to again welcome our guests, Attorney N. McNeely and Carol McKinney Rice, who are our guests today, and our other host, Attorney Charles Robinson from the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, and we're here discussing the subject abortion and the Texas Heartbeat Act. And I'd like to open up to some thoughts about what your thoughts are about how this issue of abortion impacts African American women and their families. I'm going to open this up to either of you to, or all three of you, to state your thoughts about this.
This is Carol. I think it is going to make it an economic impossibility for many women because of the what will be required in order to obtain an abortion for a woman in Texas that will probably have to travel outside of the state in order to receive services, for starters, because those that have means were always able to, you know, make things happen. And so it'll be those women who lack the economic resources to find those services.
I think that's a good point. Which kind of brings to question what was the actual goal here of this legislation. By putting it in place and, you know, going back to Carol's bounty hunter analogy, you know, the law invites lawsuits against anyone who's going to perform or bet an abortion, right? So it means anyone who, as you said earlier, talking to someone about abortion or one who might actually perform it, but even friends, families, relatives, strangers who pay for an abortion, including people who donate to or administer abortion funds. You know, all of these people can be held under this law, and being held under the law means you could be sued for up to $10,000. For your participation. And the law is written strangely. It kind of contradicts itself a little bit. I don't know how they will ever enforce this, but at any rate, it will discourage abortions, and it will render, especially women of limited means, you know, it'll relegate them into having the children that they are, you know, they're pregnant with, and those who have means might find other ways. But this law does cover anyone who leaves the state of Texas and tries to get an abortion as well. So you can, apparently you can sue someone as a who aids and abets a Texan in another state. I don't know how they would enforce that, but it is part of the legislation. But does that mean that if more and more women in poverty will have children, will that increase the population of Black and brown babies? I don't know. So when you're with your question about the impact of this law on the African-American community, yes, those with means might be able to figure it out, but overwhelmingly women will have to have the children. And I don't know if the law was put in place to address that. I mean, will there be additional services for people who are women with children, women out of wedlock with children? You know, will there be more educational facilities made available? I mean, so this could really be an interesting ripple effect. It could definitely increase the population of African Americans in Texas. But what is everybody else's thoughts on that? Especially, Carol, what do you think? I don't mean to be the moderator, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I believe that, you know, it's interesting that, you know, they're willing to, these laws and the creators and even the proponents are for, you know, banning abortions. But on the flip side, what are they doing? Where are their efforts to take care of those children once they've gotten here? You know, just as Dr. Janine said, there is a that post-birth abortion where you have women or family that you know, they basically divorce themselves from those children by withholding nurturing and care, maybe because, and financially, because either they don't have it, mentally they're not able to give that nurturing spirit because of a certain situation, especially in instances of rape or incest. I mean, reconcile care for someone who is the product of, you know, an action that violated you in the first place. So it is, it's extremely distressing to me, and it bothers me that there seems to be no clause for rape or incest, and very little room for whether the mother's health is in danger. You know, so that's kind of where I stand with that. It's problematic. And I believe it's just downright evil what they're trying to do. And you're allowing people from anywhere to sue. You know, you don't even have to be in Texas to sue somebody who might have given someone a ride to a clinic, from what I understand. And I understand that even the rideshare companies like Lyft and Uber, you know, they've had to weigh in on it because, you know, are their drivers going to be held liable if somebody calls an Uber or a Lyft to go to a clinic, you know, just even to get counseling about an abortion, let alone to get one?
Yeah, the law says anyone who knowingly engages in conduct that aids or abets the performance or inducement of an abortion, including paying for reimbursement of the cost of an abortion, or if the abortion is performed or induced in violation of this chapter, regardless of whether the person knew or should have known that the abortion would be performed or induced in violation of this chapter. Yeah, this, I don't know how they can enforce this. And Charles, I know you made something, you made a comment when you were speaking earlier about standing. I think quagmire.
I'm very curious about how the Supreme Court could let something like that stand. You know, the concept of standing is the legal doctrine, which says basically that in order for you to bring a lawsuit against someone, you have to have something at stake. There's got to be some kind of relationship. Now, people who don't even live in Texas, sounds like, can actually complain against or file lawsuits against someone who's trying to get abortion in Texas. I mean, I don't know how they can enforce something like that. Also, I heard that if anyone wants to challenge the law and lose, you know, they'd have to be responsible for attorney fees.
Yep.
And if they can't pay the attorney fees, the attorneys have to pay the other attorneys the attorney fees. I mean, the way they have that set up, it's like it's discouraging any challenges to that law. And now there's another state, Mississippi, has a pending case which is similar to Texas, and kind of like, you know, the school desegregation cases. You know, the way they structured those cases to be presented to the Supreme Court ultimately, you know, created Brown versus the Board of Education. Looks like that's what they're doing with the abortion cases, which are being lined up state by state, ultimately to be presented to the U.S. Supreme Court, which at that point will look like they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Wow.
Well, we have some possible calls. I don't have a number, but I see a name, Cicely. Cicely, did you have a question or a comment for us?
Oh, no, I was really just listening. The only question I was thinking of is if someone was to assist a woman who wanted to have an abortion and they were from another state, what would they still be able to sue? And I don't know if Lynette can answer that that question or not.
Well, we'll give her a try.
Okay.
Yes, from what I understand, that individual can be sued. Now, let me see if I can find the actual language in here. So looks like if you are from out of town, the law will reach beyond Texas's borders. Out-of-state defendants could be subject to this law. So residents of other states. And it's a little complicated how they would be able to bring you into court, because apparently the lawsuit would begin in the county where a substantial amount of the process occurred. So where the abortion was had, if it happened in Texas, or if there was some other, or where the defendant, or I think it's where the defendant or the plaintiff lives. So that's how you can select venue. So if a plaintiff's sitting in Texas, they could sue in Texas and then put your name down on there. But can the court call you in, make you answer, can they enforce any civil judgment against you? The question is still out there. The more insidious part of the law is that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove their case. The defendant has to prove that they didn't violate the law. Right. And so that's so much such an anomaly in the court system that I really can't speak to it, you know,
okay.
That's just not the way things work.
I was just going to say, that's the part that really I was thinking about, is that if I'm in Wisconsin and if I just, you know, for grins and giggles, have a GoFundMe to help the women in Texas who are underprivileged to help them get an abortion, you know, for whatever reason, Texas being a border state, how are they going to go outside of that and then, you know, sue me in Wisconsin?
Right.
Excellent question.
Yeah, excellent question. And that's
one of the issues with that is that, you know, they're also trying to prohibit people from helping women in Texas, because then if you are called into court, then as someone from Wisconsin, now you've got to pay legal fees to go represent yourself in court. You've got to get to Texas. You've got to stay in Texas for, you know, the court proceedings. So it's the whole thing is rather insidious and just, to me, just
and that's the part that's interesting, is because how is Texas going to enforce their law on a Wisconsin resident?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe the Supreme Court will carve out a new legal doctrine, kind of like when they carved out that corporations were people and money was speech. Maybe they'll come up with something like that.
Yeah, maybe they'll call it Jane Crow. But to answer your point, Carolyn, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, based on Citizens United, you know, where we came up with these, you know, with these creative ways to allow someone on one part of the country to control the outcome of a school board election on the other side, on the other part of the country.
Right.
And allow dark money, you know, to be the determining factor.
Right.
So, you know, our legal system, you know, it's based on what they call it, stare decisis. And
right.
whatever decision is made, then that's the law. It's not black letter law, but you have to, you know, come in with similar issues and fact situations and prove that the case is going to follow that precedent or not.
And then there's the issue of diversity, right? I mean, so if the defendant is in another state,
right? And the issue needs to be resolved in court. You can move that to federal court, right?
Right.
And especially if you're looking at a $10,000 fine per abortion or per assistance on the abortion, you know, you're going to hit that, what, the $75,000 mark too for what will bring a case to the federal jurisdiction, in addition to defendants being from out of town. So now the question is, how is the federal court going to massage this case, right? Especially when you're dealing with people from outside of the state of Texas. But more insidiously, again, this law will, you know, do some damage even if you win. From what I understand, if the defendant wins, let's say they're sued on this law and they come into court and they prove that they didn't violate the law. I'm sorry, that's funny to me. But that individual, if they win, will not be entitled to retribution on the cost of their defense. They'll still be on the hook for the cost of all their attorney fees and litigation. So this is, like, once again, this is posing a very difficult situation. And the second that Texas does try to enforce this outside of its own borders, I think that's when you're really going to start seeing more activity from the Supreme Court, and right-sizing this new law, if not completely, calling it unconstitutional.
Do you think that maybe that's their strategy to, through the back door, create federal jurisdiction for these
that's
cases?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Because right now the federal courts don't have jurisdiction over these cases. Because these cases are dealt with on a state-by-state basis.
Yeah, that's true. But once again, you know, what brings you into federal court is going to be the issue, right? And that has everything to do with the parties and the amount of controversy in the controversy, right? But, you know, back to that whole standing issue, though, like, normally a plaintiff can only bring a case if they've been injured, right? So you can't just run around and say, hey, I'm suing Walgreens because they sell, you know, lipsticks for too much money. And I never bought a lipstick, but hey, it's just too much. You can't just, you know, there has to be an injury, right? So I have to go buy the lipstick and then suffer that price. And now I have a case, right, that I could probably pursue. But what about abortion? I mean, how does that plaintiff get into court, right?
Well, I'm just looking at what could the Supreme Court possibly create as an injury, a fictitious injury, which will allow people to get past the standing issue. I'm just wondering, what could they possibly create for injuries?
So the Supreme Court said that in order, it's like a three-part test, right, to decide whether or not you can bring a case as a plaintiff. So you have to have suffered an injury in fact, so that the injury is of legally protected interest, which is a concrete and particularized and actual or imminent. So that's one. Two, there must be a causal connection between your injury and the conduct brought before the court. And then three, it must be likely rather than speculative that a favorable decision by the court will redress the injury. Now, three might be covered, right, because of this new legislation. But the first two, I don't know how plaintiffs could show that they suffered an injury in fact, because some girl over there had an abortion and that guy gave it to her. It's just too.
I don't see it. I can't make the connection. I can't make the connection.
Yeah, and what's your injury?
Right.
Well, as I'm hearing the discussion among the attorneys, and it occurs to me that perhaps what Texas is doing is testing the waters. It's not sounding as though this is very sound approach for Texas or any other state. But what I'm getting a sense of is it may be an opportunity to feel out this country to find out where we stand as a result, as it relates to abortion. And I think that we've had enough time of somewhat tranquility on this subject that it may make it easier to come in and really do the reverse of Roe versus Wade from this on the standpoint of the Supreme Court, and where we don't have the same sensitivities, we may just say, well, you know, it doesn't affect me. I don't know anybody who's died having this procedure. I don't know any hardship really that people have. So, okay, let's let it slide. Let this happen. And I think that clearly as we talk to people about abortion, people are not as passionate and not as emotional about it as they were in 1973. I think there are.
That's an excellent point. An excellent point. And that's why we need Carol. We need more people like Carol to advocate. Since Roe versus Wade, people have been trying to tear down, you know, reverse Roe versus Wade. There's been a lot of advocacy against Roe versus Wade, but very little advocacy to resist that. Advocacy against Roe versus Wade. And that's why Carol is so important.
Yeah, and I believe this law is just another intimidation tactic to scare people into submission to what they're trying to do, which is, I believe, ultimately to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I was just reading that what the Texas law does, it allows any private citizen to sue Texas abortion providers who violate the law, as well as anyone who aids or abets a woman in getting the procedure. Abortion patients themselves cannot be sued, but,
right.
You know, it allows any private citizen, you know, anywhere, basically. And so, you know, I could sue somebody in Texas and, you know, and if they're, and be rewarded with $10,000 if my suit wins.
That's outrageous.
And I don't have to know any of those people.
We know there are a lot of ironies and inconsistencies and hypocrisy in this whole abortion thing. When you go back, as Attorney Lynette mentioned earlier, the origin of Planned Parenthood came out of someone who was actually trying to exterminate Black people from the United States. Margaret, what's her name? Margaret Sanger, right?
Sanger, yeah.
And now we have a situation where that's morphed into what we have right now. But Hitler was using Sanger, right? I mean, that was,
yeah, they were best friends.
They were best friends, right. And she, in her autobiography, you know, she mentioned how she was using the Ku Klux Klan to advance and advocate for eugenics and the extermination of Black people. And now that has morphed into what we have right now.
Right.
It's 7:30, and we need to have one more sponsor announcement. And then it shouldn't take very long, but we have to honor our sponsors, EDOC Advice. We provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of eDocs who who are licensed physicians and health professionals who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. Also, other sponsors are welcome as well. So if do you have a service, and I'm talking to the listening audience, do you have a service you want others to know about? Have you written a book that we need to read? Consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at sankofa_think@outlook.com. And those who are inclined to submit a contribution to support our broadcast efforts, they can be made at Cash App, $NIRVANAINSTI. That's Cash App, $NIRVANAINSTI. And also at PayPal, sankofa_think@outlook.com. Dr. James.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I love it.
Very, this is a very interesting conversation. And I'm taking the back seat because this really is a woman. Women should be leading this conversation. And so I'm taking the back seat. I'm sure a lot of brothers have some things to say, and especially in areas where, you know, Black men are not integrally involved in their children's lives. And it looks like we are the villains here. And that's not the case, because I can attest that Black men do love their children, and what shows up in the media may not necessarily be the truth. And that's another conversation, perhaps.
Well, you know, right. What I would like to say about that is that we need more men to step up and become women's allies and speak to recognizing that it is a woman's right to have control over her own body. Right. Unfortunately, I think that, you know, we get a lot of silence from men because, one, you know, they say, oh, well, it's a women's issue, but we need you to stand up and say and fight for us and our rights as women for our reproductive health, for abortion rights, you know, and just for women's health in general. So we don't need our brothers, men, to be silent. We need you to stand up and, you know, and say, hey, you know, it's we want to be involved in the conversation, but we realize that it's your body and ultimately the decision should be up to you, and to stand up to other men to say that, look, this is not your place, you know, to make this decision for women, because you don't have a uterus, so how do you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, just from my days in college, this is I don't recall a guy's ever disagreeing with the decision to get an abortion. You know, so in other words, there seemed to have been support for that, at least 30 years ago when I was coming up with my friends, because I was amazed at how many women would just casually get abortions. But the Planned Parenthood facility was right near campus, so people would go there regularly. And I don't ever recall a guy having a problem with that. But that was just my small network of people. But I did want to speak to the issue of the history again. Because, you know, I find as being Black in America, the, you know, our issues the way issues impact us is always like in a bizarro way. You know, it's never the way it's happening for everyone else in society, right? When it comes to issues that impact our community. So Charles touched a little bit about that on that history. Like, so abortions for, you know, mean something different for Black women than maybe for white women historically, right? If you look at, you know, because I think Dr. James, you mentioned that, you know, people don't have the same fervor about abortion today as they may have in 1973, or about a woman's right to choose. It's just not the same passion. But I think that might be because in 1973, times were just so much different. You know, Jim Crow just stopped, right? People were coming back from their, you know, people were living on farms, you know, where they had 14, 17 children. And that was a good thing because then you had more hands to do the work, right? And we were moving into cities. And, you know, and then the not so nice thing to talk about in 1973 is the fact that, you know, if you were married, there was no such thing as rape, right? There was no such thing as sexual abuse, or at least the definition of sexual abuse, especially if you were married, was very limited. I think even you could beat women, I think, still in some states in the early part of the 70s, late 60s. And the world was just a different place. Women were considered commodities and things that you could, you know, do things to, right? And things have changed. I think women were revolting from those conditions as well, right? They wanted the freedom. They wanted to be respected. They wanted to be able to participate in the economy and be held out with the same regard and equality. Now we're 50 years out from that.
They didn't have the same opportunity back in those years. Yeah, exactly. And now they have more resources, more opportunity.
Right. And it's a different time in 2021, especially for young girls. They're not taught what a woman's place is. Like women in the 70s, you know, may have been taught that, right? I remember hearing that a lot more, you know, when I was a kid than I've ever heard in the past 5-10 years, right? Now women have a little bit more autonomy, and they're not expected to get married. They're not expected to be, you know, these things that may have been expected of them back in the day. But for Black women, you know, I think, you know, I don't know if we had the same history. You know, we in the 1970s were dealing with a lot of other stuff. And you know, I think having children, I just never, you know, maybe y'all can correct me on this, but it's just the whole abortion issue just didn't seem to be a thing for the Black community. Because, you know, while it freed white women, you know, abortion was used as a way to control the population of Black. And so now somehow it's flipped. But I wonder if, I mean, was anybody else aware of that history that of Margaret Sanger and how it was used to, how abortions and even sterilizations, right, were used to control the Black population, to get rid of it? You know, for me, I just take a little pause, you know, where something's good for the majority culture, you know, I don't know, and it, you know, historically, never really was good for us too. You know what I mean? So I'm just trying to figure out where we should stand as a community today.
That's a great point. You know, the name of our organization is Sankofa, and Sankofa means, looking back, reclaiming your heritage, your legacy, looking back and reclaiming that which you left behind. And so if we do that, historically with the Planned Parenthood thing, then if we kind of like look at how that turned into what we have right now, it might actually give us a better idea of what we should be doing for the future.
Well, I think the point that Carol made, which is really very provocative, from the standpoint of, is this a time or a way that we really need to begin to hear from Black men who have an opportunity to do some things that they perhaps have not really been able to do much of, and that is to protect us?
that for so long they really did not have much of a way to protect us, despite some of the horrendous situations that we faced and that ultimately faced that family. And I have been interested, as we've been involved in this discussion of health disparities and infant death loss and maternal loss, that you're not really hearing anything from the men. And I can understand perhaps the fact that you're happy, certainly if that woman is able to get that abortion, that lets you off the hook in terms of some of the financial and social responsibilities. But I think looking at this from a broader picture from what Carol has brought up is that who really is looking out for us and seeing that we receive the care, the support that we need, because I can certainly tell you while you're pregnant, you really cannot advocate for yourself very well. And I think that outside of the role of the legislators that I talked about in the ancestral profile for Lloyd Barbie, Black men have been pretty much quiet. And I think even from the standpoint of challenging, let's say, the Texas legislators, that you are taking a position that serves to potentially compromise the health of Black women. And that's a problem that should be conceived as a problem. And I think women need to notice more the activity or lack of activity that we've played or has been played by Black men in protecting us. And I'm just wondering anybody else's thought on that.
Well, yeah, Charles, what do you have to say for Black men out there?
Very quickly, because I know other people want to chime in on this, you know, economics, I think, and not just economics, but I think over-incarceration, especially since the 1970s, and that's also the same time period when the cost of labor began to remain the same. So, and that's definitely had an impact on the Black family. In Wisconsin, we are at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of children in certain age groups having actually living with their biological parents. And so I think there's an economic impact on Black marriage. And also we know that relationship between Black men and Black women has been suffering as well. And I remember my grandmother saying that the question was, when does the parenting process begin? She said, before the children are born. So, and if that's the case, and I agree that Black men have not been involved as much as we should be, before and after the child is born, and it still takes a village to raise a child.
That's the truth, isn't it? And I think I go back to my other statement about the complexities of being Black in America. You know, there's been near a year or decade where our community hasn't had forces working actively against it and actively against the stability of it, right? So when we view each other today and look to each other for comfort or support, you know, that's a complicated situation because of all of the other factors working in or in play on the community, right? So the question is, are Black men supportive of Black women? You know, I would have to say that's a, you know, to be colloquial, hell yes. You know, I think that there's definitely support, and do Black women support Black men? Yes, we're here. But I think the way society is set up, and Charles hit on it with mass incarceration and, you know, underpayment or underemployment and no employment, and the other factors of police violence, you know, and schools working against us, you know, we don't get to the point of stability where we can execute on the passion that we have for one another. But I also think that may be the goal of things, right? There's a power structure working to make sure some of this stuff is going on a continuous basis. But as far as for abortions or addressing those issues, you know, I think that's another complex situation. You know, a father who's politically conscious and aware of, the need for strong Black families may have some issues with abortion, right? Because he wants to produce those children and create, you know, the greatness that we need in our community. When it comes to men who are supportive of women getting the abortion, you know, it's a little strange there too, because those guys might just want to keep rolling and playing and doing what they do, you know, being out in the street, you know, and on to the next one, you know what I mean? So it's like, is that guy looking out for the woman's interest because he supports abortion? I don't know. And is that man, that father who wants her, you know, the kid, or who's against abortion, is he the enemy? I don't know. There's a complexity around that issue for our community.
That's why I'm pro-choice. Because it is an individual choice that should not be legislated. It is a choice.
Right.
I'm not
to be legislated.
Pro abortion, you know, but you know, I understand that I can't tell you what to do with your body and what your situation is. You know, and so that's my biggest issue. Is that it's a choice that should be an individual choice that should not be legislated. And you know, as far as the Black family is concerned, I believe that, you know, between a man and a woman, it should be, you know, they should be given the opportunity to work it out together, because, you know, economically, you know, like it was mentioned, you know, we're not living on farms where we can afford to have, you know, 10 kids. You know, most people are living in urban settings, and so, you know, to have a situation where you have an unexpected pregnancy, like Dr. James said earlier on, you know, you have a family where, you know, a grandmother is now pregnant, can and might even still have kids in college. You know, what does that do to the economics of that family to bring another, you know, to bring another person along? But again, to me, it's an individual choice. That family should be able to make those decisions for themselves without being legislated, you know, to be forced into a situation that could be detrimental to their family. Now, if they come to the realization that we'll make it work, we'll figure it out, fabulous. But if they find that they can't, or that the woman, you know, cannot, that it should be her choice. It should be her choice to make that, to be able to make that decision for herself.
Right, because she's going to have to live with it every day.
Exactly.
No
exactly.
Breaks, no sick time.
Right.
Right.
Right. And all of those people who are fighting against the right for a woman to have a choice, the pro-lifers, you know, maybe we ought to be advocating
and showing the hypocrisy that exists when, you know, when we look at the, you know, the Black Lives Matter situation, or, you know, the death penalty states, and how they, right, you know, how they honor life.
Yeah, doesn't Texas have the death penalty?
Yeah, they got the death penalty. Actually, Roe versus Wade came out of Texas originally. I mean, that was a Texas case. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would certainly like to see where are their efforts, you know, where are those anti-abortion efforts on the other end, once the children are here, what are they doing for those children and those families and those women? You know, are they making sure that they're able to get adequate prenatal care? You know, are they able to, you know, get adequate child care and just adequate female reproductive health care, you know, post having a child? You know, you've prevented them from having an abortion. But what services are you offering? What are you doing to offset things? So, or are you making contraceptives available so that abortions are, you know, become unnecessary? But, you know,
we should balance it out with the men.
It's easier for men to get Viagra than it is for women to get contraceptives to prevent pregnancy in the first place.
Exactly. Maybe
and
that should be balanced out.
A whole lot easier for men to get a vasectomy than it is for a woman to have her tubes tied.
Right. And a vasectomy is reversible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dr. Jay,
yeah, it is. Yes, it can be. Yes.
It can be. Okay. So you would think that there would be more effort on the man side, if that process is reversible, in order to, you know, keep, you know, in order to plan your families, I put it that way.
Well,
unfortunately, men are, you know, and I'm not saying all men, and I don't want to, you know, lump everybody together, but unfortunately, it's still that macho mentality that, you know, if I can't produce, then, you know, something is wrong with me. So that, you know, it's like, that's the last, you know, that's not going to be popular.
That's patriarchy,
well,
right?
Blank, so.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dr. James, were you about to say something? I heard you chime in for a minute there.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Oh, no, I just thought you were chiming in earlier. But
yes, I was saying that I wish we could be more vocal, even among other men, to encourage men to consider vasectomy. As Charles mentioned, that it's the possibility of reconnecting the tubes for men is much more successful and with less health risk than it is for women. And I think it may serve to be helpful in the fact that we are seeing, despite the presence of contraceptives, men who are fathering multiple children in multiple households, which there's no way that they're going to be able to father and support those children. So that this is one of those opportunities, perhaps, to promote that which would, from a scientific standpoint, be a viable thing to do. But we are coming to that time I want to thank so much having our guests here, Carol McKinney Rice, attorney in McNeely, who have brought such a thought-provoking conversation for us today. I'm most appreciative of my Sankofa member, Charles Robinson, being here. As always, he's has a wealth of information to share and perspective. And so I'm most happy that he's here. I thank the Sankofa Council for its support of this program and for sharing their vision for unity following Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives. We look forward to bringing to you more programs that we hope you will enjoy. Visit our sponsor, www.edocadvice.com. I want to say good night. Stay safe from Dr.
James.
Yes.
Do I have a few seconds? I just have to acknowledge Attorney Lloyd Barbee, who was my mentor, by the way, who talked me pretty much into going to law school because I was planning to teach and coach as a career, and which I did, and then I eventually went to law school. But also Attorney James C. McNeely, who happens to be Ian McNeely's dad, was the other person who supported my being in law school, and not just myself, but other first-year law students who he helped to get through the admissions process when he was a second-year law student, and also vice president of the law student body at the University of Wisconsin. So he did a lot to open the door in a situation where there were only 12 black law students and a law student body of 900. And in my class, we brought in 36 at one time, thanks to James McNeely. So that's Ian McNeely's father. Yep.
Power to the people, right, Daddy? Yeah.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the invitation to participate.
Yeah. And Dr. James, Mr. Robinson, Carol, I didn't know you were my soror, Carol. So excellent. I think you did tell me once. But
yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts. I'm so proud that this show is on the air, and I pray for it to reach the right people so that we can create that solidarity that we so need to support the resilience that we know we have. And my heart goes out to the community and what is to come for our success. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
And Carol, we should talk, Carol, because I'm working with a group of men, a virtual empowerment, healing empowerment circle for fathers. And I think maybe fathers should be getting behind your efforts, your advocacy efforts as well. So we should talk.
Hey, baby, hey, 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 beautiful color. Come along to kiss me. Yeah, far I'm going. Come along to kiss me. Yeah, far I'm going. Don't you kiss me nice, nice.
Ah, so young.
Yeah, far I'm going. Don't you kiss me nice, nice.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, far I'm going. Come along.
Come along.
Come along.
Come along.
Come along.
Come along.
You meditate.
Won't you meditate? I send a messenger to tell you that I want to meet you at the station.
The station.
Come along to kiss me.
Oh,
yeah, for